Good afternoon and welcome to Tom Harris USA episode number 65. This is Tom Harris in Chicago, Illinois. And last time I talked to you, I just talked about how we had just had a couple inches of snowfall and kind of a light powdery snow. And I spoke too soon in that case because the day after I recorded that show, we had another 6 to 8 inches of snow here in Chicago and right here along the lake. We probably got a little bit less snow than they did out in the burbs. So actually pretty heavy snowfall last week. However, over the last few days, it has actually warmed up a bit. So a lot of that snowfall has now melted, but we do still have, and I'd say it's about good, 3 to 4 inches of snow on the ground as we speak. And of course, out in the alleyway behind my building, it's all very packed down and lumpy, but it is really kind of nice out right now. And I was out and about earlier, had to go up to Evanston for a meeting, and I'll tell you about that in just a minute. That was nice to kind of be out and about. So I went to the grocery store and did some bits and pieces running around. Yeah, so weather-wise, things have been pretty cool here. Been kind of slow on the news front. However, I do want to do a shout out here to Doug in Akeley. Doug is a good friend of our program and has been going through kind of a rough patch being unemployed, but Doug got a temp position this week. So hooray for Doug. And I know a temp position doesn't sound like much. It really doesn't sound like much, but when you've been out of work for a while, and especially if you're in a small town in Iowa, I know how slow things have been here in the job market. I can only imagine what it would be like in a little town like Akeley. So grats, Doug, and I really hope that, you knock them out and they, you'll see that, you're a hard worker and reliable and all that, and will maybe offer you maybe a full-time position. I mean, that would be the ideal, right? Hopefully that'll happen because, we all need work. Now, on the job front, I've had a few things happening and it's a little bit premature to talk about them, but I've had a couple of inquiries from a number of sources, including one that was kind of came by surprise, and that is the position that I just left. They are talking about maybe calling me back to work. Interesting idea there. And I have very mixed feelings about that. Partly because the situation, if I were to go back, would be the same situation as before I left. In other words, me coming back wouldn't actually solve anything for them because they would still have to find somebody to work out in Wheeling eventually, if that in fact happens. And I guess the thing is that nobody knows and they're interested in having me come back. So we'll see how that works out. And I don't know. Obviously, I have other priorities as far as jobs go. And I don't know if that's an ideal situation for me, but it is possible that I may be going back as a helper, rather than going back full time, going back sort of as, just to help them out, help them get caught up, help them this and that. And that, that may happen. I can certainly see why they would like that idea because they wouldn't have to train another person. It would just be me who's already been trained and who already knows how they do things there. If that happens, that'll be some much needed income coming in. And so, I'll keep you posted. The other thing that happened was I had a call kind of out of the blue, from one of the agencies who came they wanted me to come downtown and interview with them, which I did on Friday. Went downtown and interviewed with them for a different position. And that would be a better position if I could get that. So things are starting to happen. And I have noticed, since New Year's, there's been a definite increase in the number of job ads and the number of job ads that apply to me, is also increased correspondingly. So I've actually, just since the beginning of the year, have applied for more jobs than I had for the entire month of December prior to that, you know, but December, of course, is a very slow month. December is the month when the holidays happen and nobody is hiring and nobody's even talking about hiring in the last 2 weeks of the year. But since the beginning of the year, I am seeing an increase now. So that's good news too. So that's kind of the news from the job front. And I will, of course, keep everyone posted. I do have some listener email here, so I'm going to get to this before I start talking about what I was going to talk about. I have an email here from the lovely Leanne. Leanne, so good to hear from you. We hadn't heard from you for a very long time, dear. Leanne had this to say about episode number 64. She says, I am so rethinking my recent decision to move to Iceland or Norway, or anywhere the yards are riddled with potholes of rotten shark parts that end up on serving dishes. Like you, I was wooed by the seeming paradise in pretty pictures, but there seems to be a darker side. Oh yeah, there definitely seems to be that. And that darker side seems to include the apparent abuse of fish flesh for human consumption. Though admittedly, I'd like to witness the liberation of the elves. Great program, Tom. I predict the next one will continue this upward trend. Ha! Joys from Leanne. Thank you, Leanne. It's always wonderful hearing from you. You'll have to let us know what you've been up to, because we haven't heard from you for so long. And speaking of Iceland, I have another email here from Robert. Robert, the erstwhile King of the Elves, had this to say about episode number 64. Dear Tom, this winky elf is not, in point of fact, an elf at all. I'm not sure what he is, and I don't bloody care. I've checked with our people in the EIA, the Elf Intelligence Agency, and it would seem that this Winky is a member of an underground movement of would-be elves. Well, that's a very interesting idea, Robert, that there would actually be creatures that are not elves trying to pretend to be elves. I mean, why would a non-elf want to be an elf? Do they love Robert so much that they actually want to become elves so that Robert can be king over them? That doesn't make any sense to me. Something else is going on here, something perhaps even sinister going on here. Now, I can certainly understand why Winky would want to be discreet. Because, after all, the EIA, I mean, he's afraid of them. I mean, he doesn't want to be dragged away by the elf secret police and stuck in a crawl space somewhere in Reykjavik. That wouldn't do. How can he help his fellow elves there? No, I have no doubt that Winky is really an elf. But maybe Robert is simply confused. Maybe Robert thinks that I'm in Las Vegas, which is, after all, of course, where they have many elvish impersonators. Robert continues, one does not have to be an elf to be king of the elves. I cite, for example, the fact that the monarchy of Great Britain is German and not native Celt, so there. Well, that is a point well taken, Robert. I mean, that is true. However, even though the British royal family are substantially German, thanks to the Hanoverians, thanks to Prince Albert, they are also substantially English. And the current queen is substantially Scottish because her mother was Scottish. So she is Celtic as well as being German and English and French and Dutch, all these other nationalities. Are you, Robert, part elf? I think that's a question we need to hear the answer to, sir. So thank you, Robert, for responding to that email. Now, Robert and I have been corresponding a little bit recently because we were talking about hiking and talking about hiking on the show, in fact, and when I went on vacation. Robert had a recommendation. I'm going to go ahead and read part of his email. He didn't say it wasn't for broadcast, so I'm just going to assume it's okay. And he said, I've been listening to a podcast found on iTunes called Dartmoor Audio Walks, which covers an area of the world that I know very well indeed. And I would recommend anyone that loves hiking and stories of mythical creatures might want to consider Dartmoor. The landscape is a print of early man. Indeed, a quick look at any map of Dartmoor shows the land specked with stone circles. I would draw your attention towards an area that I know like the back of my hand, for I come from that area. Now, I thought you came from Iceland. Are you actually originally from England? That would be interesting. And he sent me to a Wikipedia page for Merivale, Devon. And that's Merivale. It's a beautiful area. And I've been through Devon before and Cornwall back in 96. and spent about a week and a half down in that area. It's just, it is absolutely gorgeous down there. Very, in a lot of ways, very wild as you can get in southern England. The thing about southern England, of course, is that it has been continually settled since the Ice Age. So there really aren't a lot of areas there that are wild per se. You know, areas that have been overgrown because nobody's lived there for a long time, but not really wild. And so there, of course, a lot of ruins there. There's, you know, the prehistoric ruins, of course, and we're talking about the stone circles and things like that. And of course, England has been one of those countries that has been overwhelmed by waves of people throughout history. And you had the Celts come in, and you had the Saxons come in, the Romans and the Vikings, and then the Normans. And so, of course, you do have a lot of distinct eras of prehistoric and historic, in fact, history in the south of England, which makes for a very, very interesting landscape because everyone left their imprint on the land. And he suggested a website. This is Dartmoor Audio Walks is the name of the podcast. And you can get there by going to www.jamdesigndevon.co.uk. And I did listen to a couple of those, and they're very, very fun. Very casual, light sorts of podcasts, nothing heavy at all. And they actually are hiking on the trail as they record, and they're talking about the different areas where they are. So Robert goes on to say, so growing up in that part of the world set the mindset of a man that embraces folklore. Matter crazy? Damn, I sure hope so, because it helps in this world, and I can't wait for the flying saucers to turn up and take me home. And you thought for a moment I was just pretending to be crazy. No, Robert, I never thought you were pretending. But as you say, being crazy helps in this world. Robert goes on in a email that I got the next day. The area close to Merivale was also the setting for the Sherlock Holmes story, The Hound of the Baskervilles. I do recall a time when walking on the moor in that area with my dog. It was misty, and off in the distance I heard the sounds of hounds baying. Ooh, I bet that was creepy. That was many years ago, and at the time fox hunting was a common practice on the moor, and the pack I was hearing would have been Spooner's hounds. You may have find this interesting also, that the story of the Hound of the Baskervilles is taken from a Dartmoor legend called the Devil Hound, and part of Conan Doyle's story was in fact written whilst he was staying at a town called Princeton, which is also the town where the Dartmoor prison is situated, and of course that features in the story. I can recall only one time when I felt, for want of a better word, spooky, and of course it was misty also on that day. I, along with my dog Tim, were close to the Merivale area and heading out towards King's Tor for a day's hiking. And Tim stopped in his tracks and then came back to me and would not leave me. Then, as often happens, a hollow of clear air came in with the moving mass of misty air, and we were in the middle of a stone circle. If you can then check the map for that area and take a southerly heading from the public house called the Dartmoor Inn. And no, I was not drinking. Oh, I don't. I believe you. I totally believe you there. I find it annoying, I really do, when the wonders of the past are attributed to extraterrestrial forces or people. It is as if our poor, stupid ancestors did not possess the brains to work out complex problems. Yeah, I totally agree with you there, Robert. And in fact, I did do a show segment on that some time ago, because I got really tired of people talking about how, you know, people couldn't possibly have built the pyramids. Even though it's very well understood how the pyramids are built. And the same goes for the stone circles. I mean, we know where they got the stones because we found the quarries. We know generally what kind of tools they used. In some cases, we actually have found the remains of the tools. You know, the technology to build these things certainly existed back in the day. So there's absolutely no reason why they couldn't have built them themselves. And you'd think, and I mentioned this in an email to Robert as well, that if aliens had built the pyramids, wouldn't they be perfect? Wouldn't they have done a better job? Wouldn't they be, you know, perfectly square, which the pyramids aren't? Wouldn't Stonehenge be neat as opposed to kind of crookedly haphazard? Yeah, Robert makes an excellent point though. Is that, and, you know, not the pyramids obviously, but a lot of the historical relics of Britain, certainly, were reconstructed by later excavators, and of course the Victorians. Now, Victorians were treasure hunters. They did so much of that. They would go and they would dig into every little lump or bump they saw on the ground, hoping to find antiquities. And of course they often did. There were so many antiquities. And even now there's a lot of antiquities that have not been discovered, and they're discovering them all the time. I was just reading not too long ago, there was a new gold hoard found. I think it's Somerset or somewhere like that. You know, one of the largest gold hoards ever found in Britain. And it was found by some treasure hunter with a metal detector who'd been doing it for 40 years. And, you know, without ever finding much more than a soda can. So, you know, these things are out there to be discovered, though progressively fewer, obviously, because farmers would plow the fields and dig the stuff up, and they'd build buildings and they'd dig the stuff up. And I think this is probably still true today, that if you build a building in most metropolitan centers in England, you have to first have a team of archaeologists come in and make sure that there's nothing underneath that's going to be disturbed by the construction. I can remember that being the case in the early 80s, at least. I don't know if that's still the case now, but I assume it is, and for very good reason. But when you've had this southern part of the country that's been inhabited by various peoples, not just the British, for so long, that you do get a lot of remains and leftovers. And of course, with that comes the rise of the folklore that Robert was talking about. And, you know, anywhere you go in southern England, for example, you're going to have some local legend about King Arthur, because that was the area where King Arthur was supposedly based. And, you know, of course, every place in southern England claims to have been the original site of Camelot. I mean, you get that pretty much anywhere you go. And you could even go to the Winchester City Hall and see what used to be billed as the original round table, which I think was carbon dated back to the 17th century. It is, very, very common. And of course, folklore is one of those things that I really do find incredibly fascinating. And especially local legends, because you always have a few of those stories mixed in that have the ring of truth. And I say the ring of truth not in as like the Dartmoor Devil Hound being literally true, that you had this glowing dog, you know, like in the Hound of the Baskervilles. I mean, that doesn't sound very feasible to me, but maybe there was way, way back in the Middle Ages, back in the prehistory, maybe there was a very large wolf or something which people were really scared of in that area. And the story has continued through the generations. You know, back in medieval times, maybe there was a wolf that was, you know, stealing livestock, and it was huge, and, you know, they tried to kill it for years and years and years, but nobody seemed to be able to. You know, it's entirely possible that that's where that story got started. And like a lot of stories, over time, the story grows. The story gets more interesting. The story gets more exciting. You know, 100 years after the events of the story, the kids are saying, oh, God, that's so lame. We see wolves all the time, you know. You know, whatever. They have to make the story more interesting and bigger and flashier and so forth. I do find that interesting, certainly from the viewpoint of sociology and from the viewpoint of history. Because a lot of legends, I'm sure, were inspired by real people or real events. Which is not to say that all of them were, but some of them probably were. And some of them are probably just superstition and nonsense. And, you know, that figures into it too. But I do find that all very interesting. Now, maybe not interesting enough that I'm going to buy into it as truth, but certainly interesting to study and to read and to enjoy. Now, as a skeptic and as a rationalist and an atheist, I do often hear just sort of gentle criticism about not appreciating the mystery of life and not appreciating folklore. And as I've said on the show before, I do appreciate that stuff. I really find that interesting. Now, I don't find it, like I said, interesting enough that I'm going to consider it fact. However, I do appreciate that mysterious things do exist. There are so many things that we don't understand about the universe. I would go so far as to say that even though we have a very good understanding of some aspects of our universe, in the grand scheme of things, there's so much more that we don't know. That it really amounts to really not understanding all that much at all. Every question we answer opens up three more. That's just the way the universe is. There is so much mystery in the universe that we don't need to make up any more. Obviously, the universe is full of mystery. The universe is full of things that we don't understand. And that's why being a rationalist is helpful. Because that it actually helps you to understand them. If you're ill-informed, or if you're ignorant, or if you buy into the idea that everything is mysterious, and that nothing is really as it seems, which is, I think, the point of view that a lot of these people take, or if you're just poorly educated, then you're never gonna really seek the truth about things. It's much more fun to believe in UFOs, or believe in Bigfoot, or believe in the Loch Ness Monster, or the powers of the psychic mediums, or believe in the miracle of bread and fishes, than it is to realize that these things probably don't exist. At least they don't exist in the way that you're thinking of them. The mystery's still there. If somebody sees something in Loch Ness, what was it? And as a rationalist, we look at this stuff and we still see the mystery. But we try to actually explain it. We try to actually figure out what's going on. We just don't take it on faith that it's something magical or something alien, except for the case that we actually look for the answer. We want to know why there was something in Loch Ness, and we're not just going to assume that it was a monster. And, you know, folklore definitely exists. I mean, folklore is its own thing. I'm not saying that the devil hound is real, but why would a story like that come to be? Very, very interesting to me. And, you know, like I said, I think a lot of legends do have their basis in something that really happened, whether that's been really grossly inflated over the centuries or not. So another interesting thing that Robert's talking about here, he's talking about walking with his dog, and the dog stopped and went back to him and wouldn't leave his side. Now, I've actually experienced things like that myself with my dog. I haven't had a dog now for a long time now, but I had a dog, and his name was Bear, and he was a Rottweiler. He would often do things like that, especially when it was foggy, and he would actually see something or sense something there. There would definitely be a presence. Now, quite often that presence was a fence or a tree. But he wasn't quite sure. You know, he had the snow or fog or whatever that was maybe blocking his senses a little bit, and he wasn't quite sure what to think. And I think dogs are very intuitive. I think that they certainly can pick up on presences. And in the case of a stone circle, suddenly you get the sense that you're surrounded. Have you ever had that feeling that you're surrounded? And I think that animals pick up on that probably more keenly than people do. And that's not to say that the stone circle was genuinely creepy in the mist. Because I think a lot of places are creepy in the mist, to be honest. But honestly, I think stone circles are way cool. I really, really like them. And I've actually been known to go out of my way to go see them when I've been in Scotland. And I mean, I went all the way to the Outer Hebrides so I could go see the Stones of Callanish. And I went out of my way when I was on the Orkney Islands to go see the Skara Brae and to see the Ring of Brodgar and a bunch of the things out there. And so I do find these things very, very interesting and very, very fascinating. Even though they have been restored or whatever over the years, many of the things have. Now, some of the things haven't been. The tomb at Maze Howe, for example, is still essentially the way it was when they discovered it. It's not covered in turf anymore, but that's because they excavated it looking for treasure. Again, the Victorians and their thing. When I was on the Hadrian's Wall, even, there was the wall looked different in different places you'd go. And that was because different people would excavate the wall at different times in history, and they would rebuild what they found to the you know, their imagination of what it looked like sometimes. And so, you know, you'd have this big long segments of the wall that didn't match. But when I talked about the ruins, I talked about the very well preserved ruins. I was really talking about the things like the forts. And of course, the idea of well preserved ruins is very relative, because in this case of the Roman forts along Hadrian's Wall, well preserved means that you have a pretty basic idea of the floor plan, and you know the ruins are going to come up to your ankles. I mean, it's not as though there's still a significant amount of structure there. And a lot of the ruins have not been, those were buried in the sod, and they would just excavate them, and they didn't try to do any kind of reconstruction on. And so that's interesting, but I am a firm believer that places have presence, which is not the same as saying that they have a personality, though a lot of people use that term, and I do too. That, a certain town has a certain personality. Well, what is that really? And why would we not apply that to any place we go? I think Chicago definitely, as a city, has a certain personality. Cleveland has a very different personality, though I still like the personality there. Or, any number of different places, they would have a different feel to them. And I found that often in Europe as well, and I found that often in the ruins. And you just kind of get a sense of, okay, the place that the ruin or the building or the town or whatever is situated. You have a situation and the air has a certain feel. The trees have a certain look, and that all adds to this very subtle intermixing of ideas about a place. And I found over the years that I tend to prefer places that have hills. And I don't know why that is. It wasn't as though I was conditioned against places like hills. Now, places that are flat are less appealing to me as places in general, which of course why I'm in a perfectly flat city, Chicago. But the thing is that, I've always loved the feel of hills and the sorts of things that you have in the hills, which is not to anthropomorphize a place. And of course, the Japanese have this whole anthropomorphization of a place down to a science. I mean, they have the whole idea that each of these trees and each of these rocks has a spirit. A whole valley might have its own spirit. A whole mountain might have its own spirit. In Japanese, they're called kami, and that is in large part the basis of the Shinto religion. Nowadays, we would refer to that as an animist belief. So I think that the Japanese certainly recognize that on a cultural level, that places have presence. And if you're standing in the middle of a stone circle, you definitely get a feeling of extreme age. And for very good reason. It's very old. And you get another kind of presence if you're standing in somewhere like St. Peter's Cathedral in Rome. It's an entirely different sort of presence. And I would certainly not say a spiritual presence, though some might. I would say, the presence of being in this big, cool cave with all these really, wonderful ornamentations and mosaics and statues and tombs. And it's a very different feeling from St. Peter's to, say, Westminster Abbey or any other church or what they call the Fairy Glen out on the Isle of Skye. No doubt with a population of elves. I think every place does have a presence. And how we explain that is kind of indicative of the different worldview we have. We can say, well, this is a magical place. Or you can say, this has a really interesting feel here. And it's not necessarily talking about different things. We could actually be talking about the same thing, except that as a rationalist, I don't think that this feeling is magical in nature. I think that it's just more what the place is, the reality of the place, and I think usually that's a lot more interesting than a fantasy about a place. Anyhow, running out of time here. Always love hearing from people. If you want to email the show, the email address is tom@tomharrisusa.com. Many thanks to Robert and Leanne and all the people who contribute to this program. I love hearing from you. So anyway, this is Tom in Chicago, Illinois, signing off. We'll see you next time.